What I'm going to be presenting to you is it's part of a manuscript that I've sent to a publisher. Whether it ever gets published or not is another question. But I've condensed a fair bit, and I want to present it to you. What I've decided to do is to give you two handouts. One is the sermon that John Newton preached, honoring the death and life of Whitfield. And this other one is a copy from Newton's diary. He copied, now this is sermon 12. There are 15 sermons of Whitfield that he heard and he wrote down in his diary. So I have a copy of that for each of you. I think I've got 30. And on the back side of it is the copy of the actual diary. So you can sort of see his writing and getting a feel for that. So if you could give out those, I'd appreciate that. Okay. So let me begin. I'll talk over the handout, but I'm glad to get distribute this because it's nice to, if you're like me, you like to see something and take it home and be able to mark it up a little bit. What you will see, and I'll read through that sermon, so you don't have to, please don't read it when I'm reading up here. But I'll be reading most of those with you, but I want you to be able to follow them. The interaction, the encounter of John Newton with George Whitfield, the years of John Newton are 1725 to 1807. 1725 to 1807. And I've entitled my paper, A Great Blessing to Me. And that's a quote from John Newton. And John Newton encounters George Whitfield. Late in 1754, 29-year-old Captain John Newton, who was just about to sail on his new ship on its maiden voyage from Liverpool, suffered something of an epileptic seizure and was forced to retire from the sea. His life on the seas had begun when, at age 11, he sailed with his father on cargo ships between England and the Mediterranean in those areas. From about age 20 to 29, John Newton had been deeply involved in the African slave trade. For much of this time, he sailed the slave trading ships owned by a Joseph Manistee, who was in Liverpool. And for him, he sailed four times. He sailed first as a first mate carrying slaves from Africa to Charleston, and then three times as captain himself, taking slaves to the West Indies. Now, just prior to working for Manistee, during a heavy storm in the Atlantic between the coast of Newfoundland and Ireland, the irreligious Newton thought he was doomed and cried out to God for rescue and for mercy. In each year afterwards, he would spend that date commemorating his deliverance and his conversion, or really maybe the beginning of his conversion was sort of intensified and made more full about 6 months later. Unfortunately, for 6 years following his conversion, though he was mostly isolated from Christian teaching and fellowship because of his time away at the sea. But that changed near the end of his final voyage when he met a Captain Clooney, a Christian who also was docked in St. Kitts in the Caribbean. Before meeting Clooney, he said, "My conceptions were, in many respects, confused, not having in all this time met with one acquaintance who could assist me." For about a month, through their long conversations and some into the night, Clooney grounded him spiritually and guided him theologically. He also informed him of the events of the evangelical revival about which he seems to have been unaware. Newton said of Clooney, "He gave me a general view of the state of religion with the errors and controversies of the times, things to which I had been entirely a stranger." No doubt this included details about the leading evangelists, George Whitfield and John Wesley, and the split within Methodism. When it came time to sail, Clooney encouraged him to hear awakened preachers in London, including Samuel Brewer, his own pastor of Stepney Meeting House in London. Well, now being unemployed in Liverpool, John and his wife, Mary, whom he affectionately called Polly, left Liverpool, returned to her family home in Chatham, southeast, about 35 miles southeast of London, England, where he could recuperate. During those 9 months of unemployment, Newton's isolation dramatically changed when, on Clooney's advice, he frequently immersed himself in the dynamic spiritual life in London. Jonathan Aiken, in his recent biography of Newton, examined the details of this period in Newton's life and calculated that he went to about 40 churches, chapels, or meeting houses. This included often hearing sermons in three different churches or chapels on Sunday and attending numerous midweek meetings and lectures. Bruce Hindmarsh observes that it was, quote, a steady Calvinistic diet, end of quote. Newton would later fondly say, when in London, I lived at the fountainhead, as it were, for spiritual advantages. You just imagine the difference between having been isolated on the sea to suddenly now being right in the center, as it was seen in England. I lived at the fountainhead. Now, because Whitfield was away on his fifth journey to America at the time, Newton could only hear guest preachers at Moorfield's Tabernacle. I want to look at the encounter of Newton with Whitfield, and I see it took place in sort of three different ways. At least I want to highlight three ways. One in his preaching, one in conversation, and the other in correspondence. First of all, through his preaching. In June, when he heard that Whitfield had returned from America, he quickly went back to London so that he might hear the famed preacher. He actually hoped to meet him, but that didn't work out too well. During the six-day visit, Newton heard Whitfield preach six times. The third occasion was in the Moorfields Tabernacle, Sunday morning, three-hour sacrament service, attended about 1,200 people. That included people from the local congregation as well as approved guests. In order to get into that, you had to have a ticket. As he described it, Whitfield used the office or the liturgy of the Church of England, interspersing at times exhortations and discourses after the manner of the dissenters, and every 10 minutes or oftener, we stopped and sung part of a hymn. I suppose 20 different times in all or more. The number of persons, the beauty of singing, the decency and regularity of the whole service, joined to the noble enlivening views he led us into by his powerful and evangelical discourses, all these being blessed by God to my benefit, was such a resemblance and foretaste of heaven as it is not possible to describe. Of the fifth sermon that he heard from Newton, he said, from Whitfield, it exceeded all the rest, and it was really beyond my imagination. I believe there were hardly 10 people in the congregation, which was pretty large. I mean, the one communion service was 1,200. The evening was 5,000, which was pretty large. Of any seriousness of all, who could not refrain from tears. Mine, I am sure, were the tears of joy. Mr. Brewer's eyes were full often. He was forced to hide his face. After hearing the sixth sermon, which Newton described as extraordinary and impressive, he returned to Chatham. Soon afterwards, though, Whitfield left for a preaching tour of West England. 2 weeks later, Joseph Manisty, that's Newton's former employer in Liverpool, informed Newton that he had obtained a position for him as tide surveyor in Liverpool, in the harbor. Newton accepted the senior government post in customs overseeing the harbor, and returned to Liverpool. Unfortunately, he had to leave Polly behind for a few months because of her ill health. Well, unexpectedly, a month after Newton started work in Liverpool, who should show up? Whitfield. He had not been there before. Well, he was there sort of once just passing through, and they asked him to preach. That was an unplanned moment. This one was planned. Whitfield arrived. This time, Newton enjoyed an opportunity he had not had in London. As he explained to Pauly, I made myself known to him the first night, went to see him and conversed with him the next morning when he invited me to supper. I went home with him from preaching and stayed with him till 10 o'clock. So we are now very great or very close. Whitfield ended up staying 6 days in Liverpool, and Newton was privileged to hear him 3 times. And afterwards, in his diary, I was able to find five separate occasions when he heard Whitfield, and all of those were in London. As he explained to Pauli regarding that time, he says, "I made myself known to him the first night." Oh, pardon, I've already read that, haven't I? Did you not notice? Okay, here we go. Okay, now, there were probably more times that he heard Newton, because there were some big gaps in his diary. The middle diary, major middle diary, there's a gap of 4 years. So there are gaps, and so you have to go through and just count and that, and glean other evidence from other letters. On one occasion of those other times when he heard him, 10 years after first hearing Whitfield, Newton exclaimed, "I heard him with pleasure, a pleasure and attention beyond what any man but he can raise. It was thus with me from the first time I heard him. It is so still." Now, take a look at the sermon that I've given you. This is this is just amazing. I've seen people take notes of my sermons, and I'm rather embarrassed by what they think I said. But you'll notice this is taken from his diary. The copy is on the back. Okay, so these are his notes for September the 13th. "Rose as early as yesterday in comfortable frame, prayed for a blessing upon the preaching to myself and to others, and a hope was answered for both. My own heart was greatly affected, and there seemed to be concern upon many of the hearers. His text was Revelation 3:20. Now, I've inserted the text in bold. Now, these are taken directly from his diary, as you can see in his handwritten script. This is his outline. He began with observing from the context the hatefulness and danger of a lukewarm spirit in religion. He divided the words as they lie, speaking first of the person, "Behold, I, the Lord Jesus himself." Second, the action, "I stand at the door and knock." The event, "If any man hear my voice and open." This is Newton now writing. He cleared this from a free will sense. God knocks at the door of our hearts by his providence, both in afflictions and blessings. But it is he only can open the heart and procure himself admission. Yet as he does this by sweetly leading our own wills to receive him, in great condescension, he is pleased to speak of it and to reward it as if it was our own act indeed. That's profound. That is really profound. So this is Newton taking down the thoughts that Whitfield is presenting. Newton is not sitting down there as a stenographer doing shorthand. He's processing the sermon as it is there. Fourth, the promise, "I will come in to him and sup." Under this, he illustrated a most beautiful experience showing how we sup. That is, how we have communion with God in secret prayer, in reading the word, in meditation, in public worship, and in the ordinance of the Lord's Supper, peculiarly so called. He applied the raising of Lazarus. This is now Newton describing the sermon that he is hearing Whitfield preach. He described the raising of Lazarus in this view. "Like him, we are dead in trespasses. We stink in our own offense before God. We are bound with our corruptions as he with grave cloths, and a stone heavier than that which was laid on his tomb lies hard upon our hearts." You can just hear Whitfield preaching it. "But the Lord by his power removes this stone. He calls us by his word. Though dead, we hear the voice of God and live. He frees us from our bands and impediments. And to crown all, he makes us sit down with him and feast with us at his own table. He not only sups with us, but we with him." And in my manuscript, I distinguish, or to help the reader distinguish between Whitfield and Newton's processing it. I have Newton's processing it in italics, personally processing it. Surely the Lord opened my heart at this time, that the tears run down my eyes with joy, that I could understand and through grace have experienced something of these divine things. Many, as I said, seem much moved. He divided his application as usual so that everyone had something. And in his conclusions, he would target different parts of the congregation, what their conditions were, so that everyone had something. I hope it was and will be a happy opportunity to many. Praise the Lord, O my soul. Then the evening, as it says, he heard Whitfield preach on Ephesians 4. All right, Ephesians 5, rather. Secondly, now we looked at the sermons, and now through conversation. I'll just mention three of the conversations that he had with Whitfield. He had others, of course, many others, but some were very influential for Newton. When Newton began as a tide surveyor, he started attending a Baptist church. But the pastor was John Johnson, who was somewhat bizarre in some of his theology and is his thinking, and was an isolationist, thought you should go no routes but his church. Fortunately, in one conversation, Whitfield wisely directed Newton to attend the ministry of John Olton, who was a more moderate pastor of the other Baptist church in town. Actually, had been started by John Johnson, and there was an issue, and Johnson had left. So Newton initially started to attend by attending them both. But after a couple of years, later switched to Olton's church, and this was very important and helpful in shaping Newton's life. To Pauli, he describes another conversation with Whitfield. He says, in the afternoon, visited him and had 2 hours close conversation with great comfort and satisfaction. When I went to go away, he invited me to sup, which I did. Amazing. The great evangelist, Whitfield. Now, during his 8.5 years as tide surveyor, Newton increasingly sensed the call to ministry. He sought ordination 3 times with the established church, or the Anglican or Episcopal church as we know it here, but each time was rejected. And he had to wait another 5.5 years before he was finally ordained. So he looked elsewhere. When a small independent church in Warwick invited him for a 3-month trial period as a lay pastor, he accepted the offer. On his way to Warwick, he went out of his way to stop in London to connect with Whitfield. As he informed Pauli, next morning scratched up pretty early to hear Mr. Whitfield. After the sermon, breakfasted with him. I wish you were with me. I'm sure he would please you. Mr. Whitfield seemed greatly pleased to find that I was desirous to engage in the good work as pastor, some way or other. And others to Whitfield, who was not one to be idle, it was important to keep going forward. When one door is closed, in this case the Episcopal ordination, you go another route where the doors are opening up. And in this case, it didn't matter to Whitfield that it was a little village church in Warwick that was an independent church and very small. He further encouraged Newton by saying, those who could speak, Newton is reporting it, to his wife. Those who could speak a word for the promoting of the cause of religion ought by no means to be silent. Now, even though in the end Newton turned down the permanent call when that was received, this visit with Whitfield was encouraging to Newton as he encouraged him to pursue his calling. Another conversation was quite interesting. I wish we were a fly in the wall for this one. Eventually, through Lord Dartmouth's influence and patronage, Newton was ordained and became the curate of the established church in the village of Olney. 1.5 years later, though, Lord Dartmouth, who at the time was president of the Board of Trade, and that was also with trade with the colonies, that was a very important role, so he had connections with what's happening over here. Lord Dartmouth invited him to visit him in London, though he did not tell him what it was about. Whitfield, who, as we've learned already, who had established an orphanage called Bethesda in Georgia, now wanted to expand it into a college or seminary. It turned out that Whitfield and Lord Dartmouth wanted Newton to be the president of the school. He met with Lord Dartmouth and also with Whitfield on individual occasions. But in the end, because of his love of the Olney congregation, and his wife's fear of ocean travel, he declined. And now through correspondence, how they were interacting. When still in Liverpool, Newton wrote to Whitfield and pled for him to come back for a second preaching mission. At first, Whitfield agreed, but later he had to cancel. On another occasion, Newton wrote to Whitfield seeking his advice whether he should accept the permanent call. A third letter was written by Newton as soon as he heard Whitfield had returned from his sixth mission trip to America. Newton, by that time, was in Olney, and he wrote to Whitfield inviting him to come and preach in his church. However, Newton did not know that Whitfield had returned from America totally exhausted. But I think it's very significant that yet despite Whitfield's weakened condition, as soon as he received Newton's letter, he sent his reply the same day. Whitfield began by affirming Newton's call to pastoral ministry and then responded to the invitation. He writes, Reverend and dear sir, Newton had only been a pastor for about a year and a half. Reverend and dear sir, with great pleasure I this day received your letter. The contents gladdened my heart. Blessed be God, not only for calling you to the saving knowledge of himself, but sending you forth to proclaim the Redeemer's unsearchable riches amongst poor sinners. God, says Dr. Goodwin, had but one son, and he made a minister of him. Gladly shall I come whenever bodily strength will allow to join my testimony with yours in the Olney pulpit. But he could not come, as he explained, as I yet have not recovered from the fatigues of my American expedition. My shattered bark is scarce worth docking any more, but I would fainer hope, wear out, not rust out. Though unable to come, the great evangelist treated Newton as the new pastor as a peer. With him, he would stand in the pulpit. Now, Newton's tribute sermon, and that's the other handout I've given to you. As soon as the news reached England, Whitfield quickly preached the sermon. It's 1 week before Wesley preached his. And he chose the text, John 5:35, he was a burning and shining light. The extract of this sermon has not been published since 1772, when Gillies included it in the memoirs of Whitfield. It is quite insightful and reveals Newton's appreciation of Whitfield, so I've given it to you now and hopefully in my to-be-published book. All right. And let's go down to line 47. I'll skip part and we'll go right down to line 47. I think it's on the other side. Secondly, his steadiness and perseverance in the truth was more remarkable considering the difficulties and snares he was sometimes beset with. But the Lord kept him steady so that neither the example nor friendship nor importunity or begging of those he dearly loved were capable of moving him. The Lord gave him the manner of preaching which was peculiarly his own. He copied from none, and I never met anyone who could imitate him with success. They who attempted generally made themselves disagreeable or offensive, we would say today. His familiar address, the power of his action, his marvelous talent in fixing the attention even of the most careless, I need not describe to those who have heard him, and to those who have not, the attempt would be vain. Other ministers could perhaps preach the gospel as clearly and in general say the same things, but I believe no man living could say them in his way. Here I always thought him unequaled, and I hardly expect to see his equal again. But that which finished, or would say to maybe topped off his character as a shining light and is now his crown of rejoicing, was a singular success which the Lord was pleased to give him in winning souls. What numbers entered the kingdom of glory before him, what numbers are now lamenting his loss, who were awakened by his ministry. It seemed as if he never preached in vain. Perhaps there is hardly a place in all the extensive compass of his labors where some may not be found who thankfully acknowledge him as their spiritual father. By the way, I think I say in the footnote on the previous side is that he came to Whitfield, surprisingly came to the little village town of Olney 8 times and preached 9. Wesley was never there. So it's quite significant there. Nor was he an awakening preacher only wherever he came. If he preached but a single discourse, he usually brought a season of refreshment and revival with him to those who have already received the truth. And here he sort of adds another point, although he doesn't say it's another point. Just notice what he says. Great as his immediate and personal usefulness was, his occasional, really in this, at this time, it all could mean like secondary. His secondary usefulness was perhaps much greater. Many have cause to be thankful for him who never saw or heard him. I've already observed that there was a something peculiar in his manner in which no person of sound judgment would venture to imitate him. But notwithstanding this, he was in other respects a signal and happy pattern for model preachers. I would say this also for Newton. He introduced a way of close and lively application to the conscience for which I believe many of the most admired and eminent preachers now living will not be ashamed or unwilling to acknowledge themselves as debtors. And Newton would include himself as one of those debtors. Now, I want to draw your attention now, in closing, to a letter I found, of all places, in the University of Toronto, in the archives there. It's a letter that Newton wrote to a man called Joshua Simmons, who was the pastor of the Bedford Meeting House, made famous now by John Bunyan, is now called, I believe, the John Bunyan Meeting House. And he wrote this letter 5 days after he preached this sermon about Newton's, about Whitfield. The letter reveals that Newton was realistic about Whitfield. Though Newton greatly valued Whitfield, this did not mean that he was blind to Whitfield's weaknesses. On one occasion, when he mentioned some of Whitfield's flaws or limitations to Simmons, the Bedford pastor misinterpreted Newton's comment. Simmons wrongly assumed that Newton valued Wesley over Whitfield. Therefore, Newton sent Simmons a copy of the sermon and explained his reason for honoring the memory of Whitfield. Last Lord's Day evening, I preached to a very large auditory or gathering on occasion of Mr. Whitfield's death. As you once so greatly misunderstood me as to think I was prejudiced against him and even preferred Mr. Wesley to him, I have sent you what I wrote of my sermon. You will thereby see, he continues, what my judgment was of him, which has been my judgment, my abiding judgment for many years. What I may have mentioned to you was not inconsistent with this. For if he had not his blemishes and mistakes, as well as other preachers have, he would have been more than a man. Second, the letter reveals how Pastor Newton probably concluded the sermon, because if you look at the sermon as it's published by Gillies, it ends rather flat. It sounds like a little bit of a lecture and rather dull. I can't hear a pastor preaching that at a funeral service, at least not ending that way. But this is how a couple lines that he adds in his letter to Simmons. Newton mentions that the manuscript he sent to him was, as far as it goes, nearly verbatim, so we're not really sure, exactly sure everything he said. But he obviously said something extemporaneously. And in all probability, he says something similar to what he said to Simmons in that letter. He is now at rest. He is now with the Lord whom he loves. He is rejoicing. One can hear these words flowing out over the large congregation that night that no doubt included many who had seen and heard Whitfield before Newton had even moved to the town. Third, that letter reveals his motives, and this is what I close, reveals his motive for preaching that sermon. As he expressed to Simmons, quote, he was much beloved at Olney and had been a great blessing to me. I therefore thought it incumbent on me to bear my public testimony to him. Now, he expands on this in a letter to Lord Dartmouth regarding that sermon. I thought it expedient and even incumbent on me to bear public testimony to his character as a minister, especially in this place, where he was known and dear to many and had been despised and been misrepresented by many more. He also admits he had another motive for preaching that sermon. He continued, besides, I expected, and even in brackets he puts, and it proved right, that the occasion would be bring many to the church and be a useful opportunity. That effort would have greatly pleased Whitfield, who used every opportunity to draw people under the sound of the gospel. Now 15 years after his first encounter with Whitfield, Newton was following the example of his Calvinist preacher, pastor, evangelist friend, whom he greatly admired. When he had first heard Whitfield in Liverpool, he reported back to Pauli that the evangelist's preaching warms my heart, makes me more indifferent to cares and crosses, and strengthens my faith. Now Newton sought to do the same for his flock and people in the town gathered that night to hear the sermon.